Welcome to Nell and Matt's Obsolete Movies, the podcast where we revisit movies from our 20 plus years, 24 years, I guess we figured it out, of collecting films on obsolete formats, perhaps also known as films from the VHS era, though I guess today's episode throws a wrinkle into that, because our film for this episode is Streets of Fire from 1984, and we have it on new season, new obsolete format. HD DVD.
Woohoo!
HD DVD. Getting it as new old stock on eBay. Before we begin, I guess we should explain what HD DVD is.
I should mention that we do have it on VHS, so we still have
it. We do have it on VHS, but we have it on HD DVD. Toshiba lost the format war and close to $1 billion when it came to deciding what kind of encoding you're going to use for your high-definition digital video disc. And, it was only on the market from, check this out, March 31st, 2006 to March 28th, 2008. They didn't even let it make 2 full years.
Wow.
So this also, I guess, updates the scope of the podcast by another 4 years since VHS died in 2004. We're now up to 2008 with what we can perhaps review. I bought an HD DVD player that probably at some point cost somebody at least $500 on eBay for nowhere near that. And it came with 40 movies.
Yep.
And then we bought some more movies. And one of the movies we bought was Streets of Fire because, well, sometimes you gotta enjoy a good failure or be rooting for it. Like, it's an underdog film.
It's an interesting film. Absolutely. But before we get into the film, so why did it lose to DVD?
I think it was just better distribution. But lose to Blu-ray. It was better distribution, much like Betamax. Sony held on to Betamax and didn't let anybody else have it. And what had happened was that Philips had shared and all the other VHS manufacturers had shared technology and formats and patents and licensed other people to make players. So the cost of players dropped quite quickly. There became this sort of diverse market of, oh, you can get a really upscaled one if you want to spend money, if you can get a cheap one, much like with VHS and Betamax. You know, that had happened. Toshiba, not learning this lesson, thought, well, if we make a format and it's our format and everybody has to go through us, we'll keep all the money. Not realizing that then you're going to be going up against basically every other manufacturer of consumer electronics at the same time. And they're going to be doing things that are more innovative. They're going to be doing things cheaper. And so HD DVD is the Betamax of high definition video discs.
So for us, at least, it pushes us further into the 2000s in terms of the movies that we can review.
Yes.
But we decided to do a movie from 1984, Streets of Fire, which is a huge personal favorite of mine, and it's an underdog film. You probably know the song from it, I Can Dream About You, which was...
If you can hold you tonight, I can dream about you.
Song was so famous. The video... that was playing on MTV had snippets of the movie that no one knew what this movie was. So it's basically was the vehicle for this particular hugely popular song. But this interesting film from Walter Hill, who also did Warriors, which is another big personal favorite of ours. And it's I love it, but it's an oddball film.
Yes. It's an interesting failure.
Yeah.
And I want to say, you know, so we also, speaking of the song, we do have, because you love this movie so much, went to Jerry's Records in Squirrel Hill many years ago and bought the soundtrack on vinyl LP. And maybe to explain, like, this movie a little bit and sort of maybe before we get into the plot, there's this really interesting The mission statement of the film, the director's statement of the film, is on the back cover of the LP. And as we're watching this movie and trying
maybe
to
he was hoping people would then watch the movie. After
yes. Or like you had to sell. Yeah. Oh, they're going to buy this for If I Can Dream About You. They're going to maybe then be interested in the
film. And I think also Tom Petty and Stevie Nicks wrote songs. So they
yes, they did. And Link Wray. And so here's a snippet of this director's statement. Streets of Fire is, by design, a comic book in orientation, mock epic in structure, movie heroic in acting style, operatic in visual style, and cowboy cliché in dialogue. In short, a rock and roll fable where the leader of the pack steals the queen of the hop and Soldier Boy comes home to do something about it. Since I much prefer films that make people remember things they've forgotten to those that try to discover something new, in Streets of Fire, I tried to make what I would have thought was a perfect movie when I was in my teens. I put all of the things I thought were great then, which I still have great affection for, custom cars, kissing in the rain, neon, trains in the night, high-speed pursuit, rumbles, rock stars, motorcycles, jokes in tough situations, leather jackets, and questions of honor.
Which is so funny though, because it's a boomer trying to make what he thinks a teen would want at 1984.
Yes.
But what we actually know is, I mean, Footloose and 16 Candles came out in 1984, and that's what teens wanted in 1984.
Yes, they wanted John Hughes.
They wanted John Hughes. And
they didn't want someone else's nostalgia.
They didn't want someone else's nostalgia. And there's a, you know, like if in Footloose and 16 Candles, there is a quirkiness to those films. There's also 16 Candles, some problem areas.
Yeah.
But that's what teens wanted at that particular time, something that kind of spoke
to them
of what meant it to be a teen in the 80s, right? Instead of this kind of nebulous, you don't know if it's the 1950s or 60s, but is it the 80s? But they have the technology of the 80s. Like, there's neon everywhere.
Well, they had neon in the 50s. But it's the where it goes weird is that soundtrack and is that music.
Yeah.
You know, all the music sounds like 80s music.
Yeah.
It is this interesting, like, rockabilly new wave.
Well, even her outfits are very 80s. Like,
yes.
Like, her, or at least performing outfits are very 1980s.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it's this performing aesthetic. Like, a lot of the music, a lot of the drums have gated reverb in it, right. aka that 80s rock drum sound or that new wave drum sound. It does that, you know. And so it's this interesting, I mean, there are ways in which young people can be successfully sold older folks' nostalgia. Just they think of, like, Stranger Things, mm-hmm. When We Were Kids, The Wonder Years.
Right.
This was, the new wave rockabilly thing didn't work.
No.
know?
And I think it's, you know, it's so funny. Walter Hill is really interesting to me because, like, The Warriors is actually, you know, based on a Greek tragedy. And so, like, you can see, like, elements of, like, you know, like Helen of Troy or whatever, you know, like you could see that he has like this really great wealth of knowledge and understanding of like literature and history. And then he makes and combines it to this, which is fascinating. It's definitely a fascinating mixture and a fascinating hero or anti-hero in many ways. And I view, you know, the Tom Cody, who is the
Soldier Boy.
Soldier Boy. He was obviously a bad boy. Instead of going to jail, went to the army and comes back. And for me, he actually definitely precedes Bruce Willis in Die Hard as this everyman hero.
Yes.
And he's a very much everyman hero. He's not actually particularly buff.
Yeah.
But he's just a tough guy who is going to fight this battle that he needs to fight. So that's kind of interesting. Like, that character is really interesting. And he's obviously not really a hero. He has issues. He has problems. But he still does the right thing by Ellen Aim. So I guess we should talk about maybe the plot a little bit.
So the plot is there's, what are they called? The Bombers. This kind of bad group of bikers that feature Willem Dafoe and Lee Ving from the Van Fear, who was, you know, not that many years removed from that infamous Saturday Night Live performance.
Yep.
there's a singer in a band who's managed by Rick Moranis. We got to talk about Rick Moranis' casting here in a bit. The Bombers then capture the singer. Soldier Boy, Tom Cody, comes home. Happens to be his sister's diner. There's a rumble. There's more rumbles. He decides to become the bounty hunter to get the girl back from the Bombers. And he gets the girl back from the Bombers. And that's the plot. And it's not unpredictable. You don't at any point in this movie think, oh, what if he doesn't get her? What if it doesn't work?
Right.
You know.
I will say there's some amazing fight scenes in this movie. Though.
There are some amazing.
Even that first scene with him basically slapping, just basically slaps the crap out of the gang member.
Yeah. And steals his car.
Steals his car and his knife. Great, great. Some great fight scenes. So you're right. There's not like a massive tension there because you know he's going to get that. You know he's going to rescue her. The Bombers actually don't even follow him. Like, they're not chasing them down.
Yeah.
So, like, there's no tension around that of, like, oh, the Bombers are going to catch them. Where the Warriors, there's that massive tension because they kind of keep encountering
things and...
Yeah, but that tension doesn't really exist. You know he's going to get her. You know they're going to get her back safe. And you know there's going to be a final showdown.
If there's tension, it's whether or not... Because also the singer is Tom Cody's former love interest.
Right.
And so if there's dramatic tension, is like, who's he going to end up with romantically?
Yeah.
Because there's also this female character, McCoy, who's also a former soldier, who's just tough and takes nothing from nobody.
And a woman.
Which
is actually really progressive for the time. Amy Madigan, who played McCoy, you know her from Field of Dreams.
Mm.
She's a really solid actress. She's been in a ton of stuff. Great, great actress. She actually read for the sister for the Reva role and decided she actually wanted to play McCoy, who was supposed to be an overweight, middle-aged, retired soldier.
Mm.
And she actually wanted to play that role, which she does a fantastic job in that role. She's tough, and she takes charge, and she just does an amazing, amazing job.
And you wonder, in terms of the progressiveness of it then, is there also a sort of celluloid closet wink with her character?
Yeah.
She keeps saying to Tom Cody, you're not my type.
Right.
And there's these failed... Actually, the whole movie is also a bunch of failed attempts at sexual tension.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You know? No, I do. I think there's a question mark around her sexuality that is not... fully explored.
Again, I think there's a wink, there's an insider handshake.
Yeah.
It's a PG film.
Yeah.
In 1984, granted, before the PG-13 split. Yeah. But, you know, there's a wink and you can find it there if you want, and if not, just keep going.
And I think that's the problem of the film. He wanted it to be PG,
mm-hmm.
So that teenagers could come and see it. And I think he didn't know what who his audience was yeah. supposed to be. And I think that caused a lot of problems. So it either needed to be much more clean and, like, much more Disney, or it needed to be much more violent. And this, like, middle road that he took just,
well,
like, didn't really work.
I think for me, it's that... And it's the most interesting thing about the film. It's so aesthetically rich.
Yeah.
But who is this aesthetic for?
Right.
It's a total Chris Gaines situation. If you remember, folks, Garth Brooks had the alter ego Chris Gaines, and it was too weird for the normies and too normal for the weirdos, and so he made this perfect slice of pie, Venn diagram pie, that no one was interested in. And in a way, I think, you know, there's bomber jackets, there's greasers, there's motorcycles, there's 1950s cars everywhere.
Yeah.
But it's too modern for people who really want Happy Days, you know, wanted the Happy Days action movie. It's too modern and weird for that.
Yeah.
And yeah, for young kids who want new wave music and concerts, and there's music is a big part of this film. It's too retro for them and too modern for... So who is this for? The other thing about this movie and the plot and the characters, and this is maybe because of some academic research I'm doing right now, it's one of those things where it has these elements of melodrama
mm-hmm.
in it. And for me, what happens is whenever I encounter melodrama as a concept and start thinking about it and reading about it, it's one of those things that you can't unsee.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you like think about, oh, there's a lot of yellow cars out today, you'll see more yellow cars
right.
than you will ever see in your drive.
Yeah.
Because, oh man, yellow cars are everywhere all of a sudden if you start looking for melodrama. And by that I mean, there's not a whole lot of depth in these characters.
No.
They react to their environment, mm-hmm. and they have very simple wants.
Right.
Money, sex, freedom, or power, basically. And they're all very transparent in that, you know, nouveau cowboy dialogue. There's this sense of, like, the whole plot of the movie is about putting things back into place. Mm-hmm. Really?
Right.
The way things should be, like, the, you know, the singer who's kidnapped should not be kidnapped. Tom Cody should be free. The sister should be happy. The end. And there is a clear resolution to it.
Right.
There's a big, you know, the plot structure is very simple. There's rising action. There's a big, huge climatic fight scene with a sledgehammer fight, which is amazing.
Best fight scene. One of my favorite fight scenes ever. The sledgehammer fight scene is amazing.
Yes.
It's so amazing. Willem Dafoe playing the lead, Raven is his
yes,
name.
Yes, Raven.
The leader of the bombers fighting Tom Cody, because Tom Cody stole the girl back.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's going to defend his honor. And it's this amazing, amazing fight scene with the sledgehammers. And it's wonderful and it's awesome. Just adore it. So for anything, if anything, check out the sledgehammer fight.
But
it's
yes.
awesome.
Which, and I will say the other thing about the film, and I, you know, saying for me the most compelling thing is the aesthetic and part of the dynamic of this podcast, right? We're watching these things in formats. You know, so we have a 1080p mid-aughts, like 2006, 2007 Vizio TV in our living room. The movie looks incredible on HD DVD, actually. We hooked up HDMI to the TV. The aesthetic is actually really interesting and immersive and kind of complete.
Yeah.
Even if...
it's flawed.
Even if it's flawed, it's such a visually interesting film with its industrial sights, its urban grime, its retro clothes, with weird... at one point, Raven is wearing black pleather overalls and nothing else.
Yeah. You know, the thing I think is interesting about it, though, like, there's some things... So, like, as we said, the plot is very, like, you know... what's going to happen. But there's, like, these kind of interesting, like, understandings or nods. Like, they know the police are ineffective against crime.
Yes, they can pull people over for speeding and stupid stuff, but when it came to the big problems of that culture, cops are useless.
And so, like, he gets that, like, you know, so, like, with the Warriors being set in New York City, this was, like, you think it's New York City, but it was, like, filmed in Chicago. It's, like,
L everywhere.
Yeah, they don't
there's
name
always
what,
an elevated train
Yeah, they
somewhere.
Don't name what city it is, but it's obviously a city.
It's this made-up city. There's an inner title at the beginning. It says different time, different place.
I think they call it New Richmond or something.
Yes, there's New Richmond, and then there's the Bayside, and there's these, like, made-up neighborhoods.
But I think it's really interesting that they say... like, the police are just ineffective against this gang, right? Which is like, okay, that's true. There's corrupt police who want money to get through one of the neighborhoods. So, like, the reality of crime, that, like, a crime in a community, how much can you really do to combat crime? Like, that's kind of fascinating. And obviously this neighborhood... that the LNAM is from and Tom Cody is from is a working class neighborhood. They're just kind of making it by. They're having to deal with crime. They're having to live with that.
Everything's grimy.
Everything's
eating
grimy.
Diner food.
And that's kind of interesting, right? Like, that part of it's kind of interesting that there is, like, this darkness to it. There's quite this darkness that exists there around living in that type of neighborhood, which the Battery, where the bombers are from, is even worse.
Yeah.
But what's the reality of kind of living in that kind of neighborhood where you could get mugged or shot or harmed in some way on a daily basis? And also, I'll tell you, the ending is interesting for me because he doesn't get the girl. Tom Cody does not get the girl, which is fascinating, which is also partially probably why people weren't interested. Because if your target market was, like, 14, 15, 16-year-olds, they're going to be really bummed that he doesn't get the girl, that she doesn't go with Tom.
Yeah, they sleep together.
They sleep together.
But that's it.
But Tom doesn't get the girl, and he knows... there's, like, actually a maturity to it. He knows he's wrong for her,
Yeah.
And knows that if he stays with her, he's going to mess up her life, and decides to leave.
Yeah.
And wow, like, how actually mature is that concept that probably teenagers weren't ready for? That your love, like, that someone you love so passionately could be the wrong person
for you, and you know that it will never work.
And she lets him go. Awesome. Yeah. Right? She lets him go. She realizes it as well, that she's better with her manager, and that life is better. But but for me, in addition to, like, the weirdness around the time and place and nostalgia, I think that also was probably really hard for that, his target demographic, that the hero and heroine don't come to get together.
Don't live happily ever after.
There's no, he's not.
Or maybe they do, just not with each other.
Not with each other. He doesn't take the gorgeous convertible and they ride off in the sunset together. It's not Grease.
Yeah.
Where they ride off in the sunset together in the convertible. He walks away and she lets him walk away.
Which, and the aesthetic is immersive, except maybe there's one thing about this film, and it's an important thing, that really, 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 really does not fit. And I think it's just one of those things where Rick Moranis as the manager, and I like Rick Moranis, in lots of things.
Yeah.
He cannot stick the landing in this part. And in a really weird way, does he mess up every single scene that he is in. He is the kryptonite of this film.
Yeah.
He finds a way to make it weird and bad.
Right. Like, so his name is Billy Fish.
Yeah.
And he is Ellen Aim, the heroine of the film's manager/boyfriend.
Yes. But you can never imagine those two having sex,
ever. You could never imagine them
having sex. Because that's the thing. If he's trying to play sleazy music manager.
Yeah.
Which, if you know anything about sleazy music manager, there would have been the notion of the casting couch.
Yeah.
Except for, you know, his character is completely asexual.
Yes.
So he can't pull off that sleaziness. He just says these really aggressive, like, I got lots of money, and I can tell people what to do. In every scene, that's what he says. And that's his only way of trying to boss people around. And all of these, like, working class people, Tom Cody, McCoy, are just not even buying. Like, we don't care. Just please shut up.
Yeah.
Let us solve this problem for you.
Yeah.
I mean, so the character's supposed to be annoying, and he's supposed to be bossy, but cannot pull off.
No.
I mean, his next role was
Ghostbusters.
Yes. He plays that role perfectly.
Yeah.
His previous role was
Strange Brew.
Plays that role perfectly. He can do Canadian weird. He can do sort of milquetoasty nerd.
Yeah.
But he is milquetoasty nerd trying to be sleazy business manager.
Tough.
And sleazy business manager.
Because he supposedly grew up in the really bad neighborhood, the Battery, where the Bombers are from.
Yes.
And there's nothing about him. He feels like he grew up in suburban Toronto and is trying to be tough.
Yes, like, he grew up in Scarborough, basically.
That's what it is. That is so hard. And he was coming from SCTV. Strange Brew was, I think, 82, 83. Then this movie was 84. So this is his second film.
And so that is what were they thinking?
I believe he was good friends with Joel Silver, one of the producers. And I think that's how he got the movie. I believe. But, you know, and so it's so funny because then, of course, there's Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. And so you have what we view Rick Moranis being, even now doing the commercials that he's been doing with Ryan Reynolds, like this kind of, you know, nice Canadian man trying to do
well,
this.
Well, yeah, role. And I think there is this, if we're talking about audience expectations and is it nostalgia, is it futuristic, is it new wave, there's also that idea, you know, in acting, especially Hollywood acting, is are there characters that, or are there actors that only play persona characters?
Right.
And that they're just really good at it. They have a look. There's a visual language to their look.
Right.
And they can pull off, you know, this is the weekend, of course, of Top Gun Maverick. You know, Tom Cruise is a perfect example of someone who got to be a big, big star playing maybe variations of the same character, or in some of those 80s movies, the exact same character over and over again.
Yeah.
And it's just what he's good at. You know, it's like putting a sports team together, you know. Yeah. You put, you know, there's somebody who would play wide receiver and there's someone who'd be a nose tackle, and that's not the same body. And Rick Moranis has a persona, and he's really good at it, and he's really fun at it. And he messes up every single scene of the movie that he is in, which is almost all of the scenes.
Well, you know, now that you say that, because Bill Paxton plays the bartender.
Yeah.
It's like they should have switched roles.
Yes.
He should have been the bartender, and Bill Paxton should have been the sleazy Billy Fish guy. Because Bill Paxton would have been able
to pull that off.
And at least Bill Paxton, you could kind of be like, oh, I could maybe see why she would date Bill Paxton.
Yes.
But there's no chemistry between her and Billy Fish. Like, none at all.
Yeah.
And it's almost like it would have been better if he just played him as a milquetoast accountant. Who kind of lucked out.
Yes. You know?
Or like this overly sweet guy, and you can be like, oh, she went from bad boy to overly sweet guy. I can get it. But there's like nothing that you can see of why they came together as a couple and why she's going to stay with him.
So strange.
So strange. The other thing that I would love to mention is the casting. The cast, there's some like amazing people in this cast. Tom Cody, Michael Perry, P-A-R-E, unfortunately never really, he never really had a career beyond B-movies. He did Eddie and the Cruisers, which the only reason why anyone knows Eddie and the Cruisers is because HBO played it nonstop.
Yes.
They played it all the time. The same with the Philadelphia Experiment, they played that movie nonstop all the time. But he never really had a big career, after this. But you have... It's so crazy because you have Willem Dafoe in an early role, amazing, like does an amazing job. Diane Lane plays Ellen Aim. She does amazing, amazing job. Rick Moranis, Amy Madigan. But there's like these Ed Begley Jr.
Ed Begley Jr. is in it.
Funny like people who are in it.
Again, we mentioned Leaving.
Is in it, which is so funny. Robert Townsend is in it.
Yeah, Robert Townsend.
The guy from Forrest Gump is in it, who the Bubba Shrimp guy is in it.
Yeah.
So you have all these like really interesting people who actually went on to like more successful careers or a little bit better known than the lead. And so the casting is actually fascinating because there is some really amazing people. And Willem Dafoe is definitely underused in this movie.
Yes.
He's probably like maybe 10 minutes total in this movie.
Yeah.
And it just would have been amazing if there were
Which
more
is also
scenes.
An interesting thing, you think, if he is the if he's the antagonist character, if he's Raven is the leader of the bombers.
Yeah.
You get the big showdown. You get one scene where he's kind of rapey. You get the scene where the bombers raid the show and kidnap the girl.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's it. And he's out.
And this was his third film. This is Willem Dafoe's third film. He was so underused, but it's so menacing. I think that's also the other thing is like, when he's on screen, he definitely has a massive presence.
I mean, he's very big. He's big in terms of the way he just fills the scenery, not like physically huge, but again, just his face is so expressive, which of course, you know, and his face is so interesting. He has like sort of a, in much like the way this film is aesthetically interesting but kind of broken, Willem Dafoe's face is aesthetically interesting and kind of broken. Sorry, that was mean. The other thing I have to mention, too, is that this film also follows the 80s convention trope, action movie trope. Bullets make things explode. When Tom Cody is using his rifle, things blow up.
Yeah.
In a really big way.
He's a great, great aim who can blow things up.
Yes. You shoot it, it blows up.
A lot of motorcycles.
Don't ask me how.
Bunch of motorcycles blow up that way.
A bridge blows up that way. Or like an overpass blows up that way. It's maybe this is one of those things that Mythbusters ruined this movie and ruined this convention. Because now we've all seen that episode of Mythbusters. And we know bullets don't automatically make things blow up.
Yeah.
but it does that.
Don't ruin this for me, Matt. It's a childhood favorite.
It is a fun movie. It's a popcorn movie, even if it is a little weird. It's an interesting failure.
Yeah.
It falls into that category, which maybe is for our big four questions. Maybe that should be a new category. If this is a new season, new format of the podcast, instead of just asking, is a camp retro classic or just an old movie, maybe we should throw, is it an interesting failure into that mix?
Yes. Yeah.
So which one is it?
I think it's an interesting failure. And I do think Walter Hill was onto something.
Yes.
In terms of the tone. Because you think about, like, RoboCop comes out a couple years after this.
Which is also sort of post-industrial. Which is also, it's Reagan's America. You know, it's also, you have to say, it's 1984. You know, people were fleeing the cities. I remember, you know, seeing footage of downtown Pittsburgh, Grant Street in Pittsburgh in the 80s. And it basically was a dirt road. I mean, now it is this, like, high-concept Brick Street Urban Boulevard. There you see the seat of power for the county and the city. Back then, it was just this patch of, like, dirt, brick, and, like, globs of asphalt. It was kind of shocking how bad it was.
And also, I want to, you know, like, I should also mention that, like, and then you have the Sin City.
As well. It's also a very similar look.
You know, prior to the movie, even the comic book, right?
Yeah.
So I think, like, you even have that. So I think that we do have films that come later that kind of have this dark tone. The Crow.
Is very much, I mean, urban space and Streets of Fire, and The Crow also looks very the same.
And also this, like, nebulous time period and some, like, retro elements into it. So I do think the tone was really interesting. They just didn't get it quite right, which makes it an interesting failure.
Yeah.
Doesn't quite get it right, but I do see, like, you, after you watch this film, you do see how it's, like, seeds in other films. They must have watched that movie.
Yeah.
Or, you know, had,
or there's, yeah, an establishment of a visual language in this film. And again, it looks so good on HD DVD.
It does, absolutely.
It looks better than it does on VHS. I will say that.
Yeah.
So, what about the social political distance? This is question two. This movie does fail the Bechdel test, I believe.
Definitely. I mean, I think even though McCoy is played by a woman, her conversations with Reva, with Cody's sister,
or
about
him. Tom, yeah.
Their conversations are about the military.
Yeah.
Between her and Tom. But really, it's like the women are just kind of...
Again, really, this is melodrama.
About, yeah.
These characters do not have a lot of psychological depth.
No.
They respond... They have they have clear objectives and desires that you don't even really have to think about and are barely established. But you understand them completely.
Yeah.
And yet, and they respond to their environment.
And I think, I mean, I did already mention, I do think it's interesting that McCoy is played by a woman.
Yeah. And a tough woman.
A tough woman.
And who also is not, I mean, her dress, her costuming is very frumpy. I mean, those are asexual or androgynous, sort of, maybe that's a better.
Yeah.
Better way of saying it, clothes. Like, man or a woman could jump into that outfit and look pretty normal.
She's kind of wearing, like, almost mechanic overall things.
Yes.
And then, you know, like, we know with Ellen Ripley and Alien, it was the same thing. It was written for a man, and, you know. So I think it's interesting that she took a role that was written for a man and really owned it and came off as, like, just a really tough woman, which there is that question of sexuality, which is also interesting that comes up. But beyond that, I wouldn't necessarily say... In some ways, though, like, at least the town people are like, different races. Like, you know, like, it's a community.
Yeah, I think that's also interesting, too, is that you do have this fable. And there is one racial slur in the film, which is, of course, said by a cop.
Right.
Of course a cop says the racial
slur. And then
slur.
Tom Cody immediately blows up the
yes, and then all the cop stuff gets blown up. Because if you shoot cop cars... They will explode immediately.
And the head of the police in the town of New Richmond is actually...
African-American, the chief, yeah.
And so, and it's a mixed-race community, which that kind of is interesting.
Yeah.
But the vast, like the main protagonists are all white, and you're kind of following the main protagonist in the film.
And so I guess then the technical distance of the film, again, it's a different time, it's a different place. It all makes sense. It's all unified and makes sense to, I think for me, a good, you know, if you've seen It Follows, if anybody's listened to podcasts, seen It Follows, the compact that is also, it's 80s cars, but then you have this, like, really interesting, like, Nook reader thing, Kindle reader thing that's that's definitely 21st century tech.
Yeah.
Those all 80s cars, and it's just like, it has this interesting off note, like, sort of beauty mark mole on the face of the film thing that happens. All of this stuff, it does make sense. The fashion, the cars, the look is consistent.
And even for the 80s, like at that time, the 60s are only 20 years out, right? So, like, there would have been people driving their parents' old car from the 60s. So, like, I think that also, because it's now 2022, the distance seems much greater than when the film was made.
I did have a thought at some point watching the film where it's like everything is old and grimy.
Yeah.
Though, depending on what year it is, some of that stuff's probably kind of new.
Mm-hmm.
That's true. You know?
Yeah.
Question four, and I think we both know the answer to this going in. Will we ever watch it again?
Of course.
Yeah, we're going to watch it again.
I adore this movie. I also find it funny. So Walter Hill was coming off 48 Hours, which was hugely popular, massive hit. And he and Joel Silver knew, like, Universal was going to let them make whatever they wanted, and they chose to make this. And I love that. Like, they could have just made how many 48 Hour movies that they wanted to. But they chose to make Streets of Fire. And I just, like, adore that. I absolutely adore it. As an adult now, you're like, I get that. Like, they took the high of 48 Hours, and they made Streets of Fire.
Good for them.
I absolutely adore. Which, you know, Streets of Fire is more in line with The Warriors, right? Which I adore The Warriors. As, you know, 48 Hours probably have not seen that in like 40 years or 30 years.
Yeah.
But this, I keep revisiting, and this I kind of find
every
fun.
Every few years
and find it fun and interesting. How about you?
I think the same. I think it's an interesting failure. And at least there's a great sledgehammer fight. I mean, come on.
Gotta catch that.
Yeah.
All right.
All right. On that note,
bye, everyone.
Bye.